So today we are moving into this another section or another part of our exploration, and we start with Gapsa. Those of you who have books, who ordered books, please take them and give money to. So I have to share a few things before we start with this wonderful book. You have seen this book, I've read some of you most probably. And I'm very glad that many people already shared that they discovered something completely wonderful and new. And I think our explorations into spiral dynamics helped us a lot to tune to this way of thinking in means or paradigms or structures of consciousness and so on. And I think even that our Vedic studies also helped a lot and prepared us to this kind of new vision. And then suddenly I was interested, because by reading Gapsa, I presumed that he's dealing with the same notion as Sri Aurobindo of consciousness and evolution of consciousness. And then I noticed that he's not using the word evolution altogether. And I was surprised. Then I looked through, I found evolution wherever he used it. And then he explains there that he cannot use this word because it is used differently by evolutionists. And we had a wonderful presentation by Rod on the philosophy of evolution. It is used in a sense that every change is fixing something, and from there we start. So to say, we forget our origins. We have no clue, we have no way back to our origin, and this he cannot accept. So he cannot accept the evolutionist concept as kind of willing to progress, the concept of progress altogether he cannot accept in those terms. Now he cannot accept also Orientalists who are turned only to the past, and he says that that idea to escape, so to say, the manifestation and to go back to origin without manifesting is also not a solution. So you can see already the thought or the vision of Sri Aurobindo. He didn't know about the concept of involution, and because of that he couldn't really formulate it, but he formulated it in his own way. It's quite interesting. From one side we have Radhakrishnan with his Indian philosophy, he wrote two volumes of the history of Indian philosophy, where he says that we cannot accept Sri Aurobindo's view, though it is very interesting, because we believe in progress. Now Sri Aurobindo believed as if, according to his vision, they didn't realize, in something that we are starting from luminous age and we kind of narrow our consciousness down, and we don't believe in that. We believe that we are progress. That's why we cannot accept Sri Aurobindo. Gapsa, on the other side, cannot accept those who believe in progress because he feels that there was an origin. And you can see the ever-present origin, it's in the name of the book. He believed that there was something luminous at the beginning, because he couldn't take that all these traditions which we have from Bible, starting Satya Yuga in India and everywhere, they speak about luminous beginning. How come they speak about this? They were so kind of stupid, and we are clever, we know, and they didn't know. There must be something there. So he saw another picture, and that was his intuition. And we are going to look into this now and see how he justifies the concept of involution. At the same time, the evolving consciousness is taking new forms. But he doesn't call it evolution because the term is already occupied by evolutionists who use it differently. He speaks about the mutation of consciousness. So this is a basic introduction before we start looking into the content. So there are two fundamental principles which he discovered, and he speaks about them in introduction immediately. It is about this latency that something is latent in this development that is involved, basically, in Sri Aurobindo's terms, which is concealed, it is his quotations, is the demonstrable presence of the future. It includes everything that is not yet manifest. It's nearly like Sri Aurobindo speaks, it's as if he is language, as well as everything which has again returned to latency. Since we are dealing here primarily with phenomena of consciousness and integration, we will also have to investigate questions of history, the soul and the psyche, time, space, and the forms of thought. Now, his book is divided into two parts. First part is dealing with these foundations, and second part is dealing with this emergence of new, apperspectival consciousness. And the second principle he is using is transparency, or diaphaneitia. It's a strange word, which means transparency from Greek. Is the form of manifestation, epiphany of the spiritual. So transparency he considers to be the form of manifestation. The spirit is being manifest through interaction with all these layers. The deeper layer comes up and conceives something on the surface and then withdraws and then again and again and again, and thus in this interaction of all these structures of consciousness, new is being manifested. There are a few interesting thoughts here. So, our concern is to render transparent everything latent behind and before the world, to render transparent our own origin, our entire human past, as well as the present, which already contains the future. We are shaped and determined not only by today and yesterday, but by tomorrow as well. Now, this is his concept of time. We will have to look into it later. It's a beautiful, absolutely amazing vision of time. The author is not interested, he speaks about himself, the author is not interested in outlining discrete segments, steps and levels of man, but in disclosing the transparency of man as a whole and the interplay of the various consciousness structures which constitute him. This transparency or diaphaneity of our existence is particularly evident during transitional periods in which we are now. And it is from the experiences of man in transition, experiences which man has had with the concealed and latent aspects of his dawning future, as he became aware of them, that will clarify our own experiencing of the present. It's a spiritual vision, I would say. He can be considered a mystic by this state. Mm-hmm. So his discovery started from that he noticed, and that was very fashionable at that time, you know, Picasso's time, all those impressionists, and the whole movement was towards the fourth dimension. We have all these Uspensky, Gurdjieff, all those people, mystics, Blavatsky, there was the whole movement there in search for a new consciousness. He was a friend of Picasso, he was visiting him and, you know, kind of appreciating his art, especially in this new dimension. So he saw that there were three major structures within the development of Western culture. There was perspectival, clear appearance in the medieval period. There was Leonardo coming with his perspective. Suddenly he clarifies what is three-dimensional perspective. And also he shows the progress how Leonardo came to it. quite interesting. His first definitions and his last definitions of the three-dimensional world, he sees clearly the world which was before that unperspectival, he calls it. Perspectival and aperspective. Now here I have to say a few words on terms how he's using. He makes these words, aperspectival, arational, everywhere he puts this R, from Greek, which is not a denial, but which is making it transcendent. There are two meanings in this prefix of R. You can transcend or you can deny. So he is using Greek prefix for the purpose of his own, coining his own terms. So aperspectival means that transcending perspectives. So he saw clearly there was unperspectival development before Leonardo. Then we have, starting from maybe, he speaks about Petrarca's letter when he climbs to the mountain and for the first time he's facing this landscape, huge landscape, and he's scared. He's scared to see space being real, space as the body, and he wants to come back to himself. And it's a very vivid experience, saying, forgive me that I got lost myself in this kind of vision. I have to come back to myself and to be with you, O Lord. Suddenly this fear that you can be lost somewhere outside, that there is outside being there. And he describes clearly the shift from one vision of when we were very subjective, living subjective life, to this perspectival vision where the directions can change everything. You look at this side of the mountain, at that side it's another world, and it's global, and it's huge, and it's scary. So from there, and actually Petrarca was considered to be, as we know, first tourist altogether, because he was traveling for the sake of pleasure. He even climbed that mountain with no other reason, which was a surprise for others. Can you imagine? People were never doing anything for the sake of other than function. So Petrarca, in that kind of spirit of exploration, suddenly he had little space for him to see other things. He was not too busy doing other things. So in a way, this was the beginning of shift towards that what we know as a perspectival world. It's quite new to us. And you can imagine that we always shift. We can also have this experience of Petrarca on the mountain. I'm sure those of you who were climbing mountains had it. That scary, huge thing, yes, which we know as the world, is questionable for us. We do not know how to deal with that. We want to kind of dive back to ourselves. We are afraid of those spaces. You look at the stars, those huge spaces. What is coming to you as a child first? Is this wonder? Yes? Wonder and kind of fear of this huge, immense manifestation. We are not sure there. It's kind of not our place. Not, we are not there at home. So this perception he develops, because it is exactly what is essential, that we are here in another home. So we were shifting from archaic structure where we were at home fully. It's the paradise of Adam and Eve when they were at home. There was no difference between soul and the world in that setting, in that structure. Then suddenly they were banished from the paradise and they were shifted, they were put into another world. So this is the fall. This is the shift from where magic structure starts. Magic structure that you have to face other setting, other world, other environment than you are used to. From there you bring all your archaic projection, as he explains, this of oneness of the world, and start seeing the world which is not yours. And it creates one-dimensional structure. And it's quite interesting. It's timeless and spaceless. There is no yet time, no space perception, no ego. But there is already something which is not your environment. And that creates this projection. And he describes with pygmies how they hunt it. It's quite interesting. They draw the picture of antelope in the morning with the sunrise, and they bring the arrow and put it to antelope drawn on the sand into the neck. Arrow is if coming from the sun. They make this ritual for them, and then they go hunting. And they bring the antelope with the arrow exactly in the spot where they put the arrow in their magic ceremony. Then they have a ritual around this picture. They remove the arrow with a specific dancing, and then they efface the picture from the side, and it takes, and then only they can use meat. Now he describes this very beautifully, even psychologically very interesting, to see that we have it somewhere in ourselves, this belief of all is related in all, and there is no ego consciousness in them. They are not hunting for the sake of survival yet. That survival is emerging somewhere in their mind, but it is not that. It is something else. They have to live. It's a part of life. They are part of this whole. There is no difference between me, arrow, antelope, sun. That's all one big world. Now, why I'm saying all this? I'm just trying to bring the dimension of experience. It comes from deep psychology within us somewhere. These levels we know within ourselves. We can really see them working all the time.
Yes.
Structures of consciousness. So he defines them as, you know, archaic, magic, mythical, mental, integral. So archaic is this primal man, Purusha of the Rigveda, before Purusha was sacrificed. All that Adam, old man, Kadmon in Kabbalistic approach, Osiris in Egyptian Gnostics. Osiris, who was killed by, you know, Python's Seth and was cut into 12 pieces and distributed all over, which made a manifestation. And this Osiris was then later gathered by Isis, his wife. She was going from piece to piece, gathering him, and this is the concept of time. She was gathering bits to gather her husband back in one, although there were 12 pieces of him. And then Horus comes, her son, and says, don't do that. I am the rising sun.
Oh, there you are.
The rising sun, new consciousness. You don't need to gather that sacrificed first primal Purusha. You have to look what is emerging in you from it, and that is me. And this is a beautiful vision. I think it is all about the same. All these traditions speak about that emergence of new consciousness in a new form, while something was sacrificed before. Before I want to go to this quotation of Sri Aurobindo, which Gapsa didn't know. It's a very famous quotation. Everybody does quote this. But I also chose this. We speak of the evolution of life in matter, the evolution of mind in matter, but evolution is a word which merely states the phenomenon without explaining it. For there seems to be no reason why life should evolve out of material elements or mind out of living form, unless we accept the Vedantic solution that life is already involved in matter and mind in life, because in essence matter is a form of veiled life, life a form of veiled consciousness. Now, he didn't know about this. That's why he develops his own vision of mutation of consciousness. He knows about something is there, it can't be that there is nothing there, and that he calls that archaic structure. That zero-dimensional primer consciousness. So he also didn't know much of India. By the way, it's a thing which is a fact. He does not refer to India and to Indian knowledge at all. very rare here and there, and usually from those Mayavadins and Buddhists. So these structures of consciousness, archaic, magic. Magic is when Adam and Eve are banished from their paradise and they have to face another world, but they have still the perception of that oneness. The primal man here becomes the maker. He has to work. In sweat and blood you will earn your bread. You will have to face the reality of another dimension. For the first time he faces the world. That's what Gebser says. For the first time he faces the world. I mean, it's amazing. Vital impulse and instinct thus unfold and develop a consciousness in dealing with nature. Witchcraft and sorcery, totem and taboo, are the natural means of freeing himself from nature. Now, since he has this perception of oneness with the world and himself, how would he deal with this nature if not through those means of witchcraft, of involving all the nature into this particular action of killing antelope? Because it is his part of his being somewhere. He believes in his consciousness. So he would have to pay attention to those realities of ritualistic kind. He has to make a ritual, because he wants to interfere with the reality in a violent way. But he doesn't want, he cannot do it. He cannot take it fully, so he makes a ritual. Mythical. Brings the awareness of the inner life of the soul, its history and its origin, the primal myth. And it's quite interesting that mythical emerges later, and I have to move into another dimension altogether, which is suddenly man who realizes that he has an origin and his consciousness shifts to his heart and chest. He orients himself towards that origin completely. He develops his inner world. This is the structure which is oriented towards the past, towards the origin, the mythical. We have it in India, we can see it clearly here, all these references to Ramayana, to Krishna, non-stop, because that is the origin from where we come. We have to recover it, we have to hold on to it, because that is the way how we have to go back to the origin. Now that leads us to Mayavada and Buddhism, that we have to drop this manifestation sooner or later and go back to our origin. He says this is not a solution either. That starts with Petrarca when he discovers that mental, that the space has a body, that the space is real objectively. We are very close to that time. We are taking it for granted now because we are already living in this time. We believe that space, objective space, is real. But that time people didn't see that. They didn't know about this. So when we move to the mental structure, it individualizes man from his previously valid world, emphasizing his singularity and making his ego possible. This is the quotation. Before, that was an egoless society. Mythical is also egoless. And you can see in India, what we enjoy, relations with Indians, is exactly that. But they are, in a way, egoless. And their relations are egoless. The ego is emerging in new form because mental structure demands it. But still, their dominant attitude is that of egoless. So this mental structure introduces a perspectival perception of the world by spatializing time perception. And this is a major issue. It represents life by conceptualizing it, distancing man from his own nature. He says that we are conceptualizing time in terms of space. And that is very true. We actually abuse time, as he says. We abuse it to the extent that we imagine that time is only the sequence of certain events. And time is not that. Time is not a sequence of spatial events. Time is an intensity, a power, and it has many dimensions. And he speaks a few of them as historical time, geological time, psychic time,
seasonal
time, and so on and so forth, and that conceptual time included. So there are many dimensions of time which are suppressed by mental structure, by the spatial, by belief in the objective space as the body, as the self, which exists. So perspectival thinking is very interesting. When I turn my head from one mountain to another, my world changes. I can look into this direction and focus on it and make it work, and then I can change the direction, forget that space, focus on this space and make it work. This was not possible before. You couldn't leave the oneness of the world. Now you can leave it. You can chop it into pieces. You can concentrate. You can plan your time. You can make use of it. You can concentrate all the energy on it. And that's what he discovers with the Spanish conquistadors who conquered great civilizations. Why? Because they couldn't resist it. These egoistic people came with their own narrow mind and conquered them because they were stronger. Stronger in the sense that the individual ego was formed. And the magic structure of that and mythical thinking of oneness of those old sorcerers which were sent, magicians, to kill them, couldn't reach them. Magic didn't work. Individual consciousness formed around the ego is much stronger. That's what Gebser refers to. And it's a beautiful reference. Individual consciousness must emerge. Though it is very tricky, it conquers the world, it chops it into pieces, but without it, there is no that next level where we are moving to that integral consciousness. That power is to be there, the power of the individual. The holistic world is to be built within one individual structure. The world is to emerge through the individual. And for that, that particular mental structure is essential. So integral, we come back to our origin, where diaphony to transparency becomes the means, and all these other structures starting from archaic find their place through this transparency, another place. And that becomes a new world. Freedom from all structures by their transparent rearrangement into one integral oneness of being. And he uses this word rearrangement instead of evolution of consciousness. It's a rearrangement of structures. It was always rearrangement of structures. And even he speaks about mental structure, that we should not be afraid to go into details, to be lost in the world or somewhere, because the archaic oneness is still calling and dominates all our ways of being lost. We can be lost, but we will be found because the archaic structure will dominate anyhow. It is still there, and it will emerge into integral structure. Integral and archaic are very close. You will see in his schemes, he gives very similar references. Integrality for archaic and integrality for integral structure. Now, before I move into this, I made few interesting remarks here. How he treats consciousness. Especially, I wanted to refer to those who are interested here, to compare it a little bit with... Suddenly I saw this picture of Mandukya Upanishad, which refers to structures of consciousness in a very similar manner as Gebser does. Mandukya Upanishad speaks about four structures. The deepest structure, transcendental, is Turiya. The dream structure without dreams is Prajna. The Svapna consciousness, the dream state with dreams. And Jagrata is a wakeful consciousness. Now, the same structure Gyabsar gives to all of these. So the Turiya would refer to archaic, Prajna, the state without the dream, without dreams, refers to the magic structure, one-pointed structure. The state of Svapna refers to the mythical structure, where you have the dreamlike state with dreams. This is the primal myth, turned towards the origin, inside living, not outside. And finally, Jagrata, a wakeful state of consciousness where you are outside and you see the space as a real being and you treat it as a real being. Why I'm saying this? Because these states are still within us. And this is all about that. If we take this Mandukya, we will understand what Gyabsar was doing. These states are there. They are always projected. Now, when archaic state of oneness is projected into another world, we have a magic structure.
Huh?
Yeah, well. And it is described like this. It consists of these three and it is beyond them. And it is exactly the description Gyabsar gives. So basically, when this oneness, our spirit, is projected into another world, we have first touch will be this arrangement of the magic structure and this magic world known to us through all those other peoples. But what we are referring to, we are seeing them already with our mind, and it's already a degraded stage. Unfortunately, we do not know what magic structure was in reality, how people in reality lived. What we see now is a degraded state. We see these people kind of hunting, we see the same mindset, but we see something else. Because there was a great civilization, Mother refers to, in Africa, which was based on this structure, but they refused to progress, and they degraded to the stage which we see them now. It is nearly animal level, but they had a great civilization. So magic civilization could be great, about which we know nearly nothing. Nowadays we see only that those degraded states, but we can figure out how they think because they have still the same mindset. It makes sense.
Don't we practice that when we make a formation about something to be manifested?
Yes.
And then we approach it from all the other angles. But behind it, we have this formation about what should be there after we go through all of the other stages.
It's very true. We are doing this all the time. We are all the time magic man. All the time. We are all the time mythic man and archaic, if we are lucky, to really stop thinking and kind of come into silence. And from there, from that origin, we will have a glimpse, an intuition. And we also mental. We organize structures. We treat time in spatial terms. So why I kind of refer to this, because I saw suddenly that this projection from the depth outside created kind of civilizations, or even times, ages. And these ages are still with us somewhere, though they are degraded in those forms and evolved in other forms, but they still, as a psychological treatment of our life, still is there, the same structures are emerging in us and creating new possibilities outside. Now, archaic, which is projected in the magic and creates the magic as a projection in the outer world and then evolves mythical and finally mental. Mental, according to Gebser, is complete deviation from the archive. We are separating ourselves finally, freeing ourselves finally from the world in which we are. We are becoming separate beings, individuals, which can manage space. We can treat space as the outer being, and it's a very cruel state. It's very merciless, but it's indispensable for our freedom from time, as he says. The soul has to free itself from time. Don't want to confuse you more, especially with time. Now we see this first space and time relationship, zero-dimensional archaic, one-dimensional magic, two-dimensional mythical. Finally we realized where to go. We have to go back to our origins. We have two dimensions. Before we didn't have that. We had only one dimension of the magical, where we had to treat, to act in the world in a particular concentration. And then we have three-dimensional, finally, mental structure. And the four-dimensional is emerging. Full identity and integrity in an archaic, unity or oneness in magic, polarity, ambivalence in mythical, duality, opposition. We are freeing ourselves from the space and time, mental, and diaphaneity, transparency of integrity. Now these things would make sense after such introduction, that we psychologically can refer to these structures. Space and time properties. If you have some questions, remarks, you can interrupt. And archaic was integral, integrality. You see, he's using similar as an integral state. Properties, no properties in archaic. Potentiality, pre-special, pre-temporal. Now magic is non-directional, unitarity, interwovenness or fusion. Unity, in its essence, it is unity by unification, hearing, hearkening, spell. Pre-perspectival. It's not even unperspectival yet. There's a difference. Timeless and spaceless. Mythical is circular and cold, complementary. Unification by complementarity and correspondence. There is the source, the origin. I belong there. I have my place, my origin, my Pitris, forefathers, ancestors. I believe in them. They lead me. They know what is best. The myth, the primal myth. Unperspectival. There is no perspective outside. It's only inner world. There is only one dimension towards the past. There is no future. And this is very remarkable, because if we take Rig Veda, we will find that there is no future tense in Rig Veda. Only in the latest part. There is no future tense. There is no such concept of future tense. In later classical Sanskrit it develops. There is only past, present, and all the modalities, but no future.
We might find that classical languages in general don't utilize very much
the
future tense.
Right.
And I also wanted to observe that the relationship, Gebser is speaking about structures of consciousness. Structures of consciousness.
Right, right.
What we've been looking at in spiral dynamics is structures of social behavior.
Right. It's a good point.
And so we can integrate those two as we become familiar with both of them and see their relationship.
So we continue to see this kind of this spaceless, you see, spaceless, mythical, but natural temporicity. So the time concept appears, but in a sense towards the past, not towards the future. So to say natural temporicity, there is no yet time altogether. There's something natural about it, but psychic time. And he will speak that psyche is introducing time. Basically, this is psyche through which time has validity for our consciousness, whereas space comes through the action of our mind. He will speak about this later. It's quite interesting. Spatial perception is a mental perception, whereas time perception is psychic perception. It makes full sense to me now. So natural temporicity appears before, where there is no yet space dimension as reality. It is only relating to this acts from the origin towards now. Now mental structure, when, as we saw, the Petrarca saw this huge thing, body of space, threatening his inner being, which he has to deal with, and from there Leonardo comes with his perspective and he draws a picture. From the eye you look to, towards the horizon, and he makes the horizon, he makes the pyramid. The first pyramid, that's like we are watching the screen, yes? We have the dot here, and we see that, and that builds the pyramid. That was his first definition of perspective, three-dimensional. But then he realized that actually horizon is looking back. So he put the dot there, and from horizon he made a screen here for the eye and the whole being. Then he got a real space. Space which is not looking from which you are looking towards it, but which looks towards you in the same way. So you have a dimension of the body of space which is real, three-dimensional. And it was a huge discovery. The beginning of all that, what we know now as all our civilization. But we take it for granted. We never thought about it, that it is really so close to us, only 500 years back.
But at the same time, there was the development of the microscope and the development of the telescope. And so the emergence of this spatial consciousness was universal.
Right.
We can see an example of it in Leonardo. But in fact, there are many examples of it.
Yes. But it was nearly at the same time, or immediately after that. We have Copernic, we have Galileo.
Only in the West, or what was happening in China and India back then, you know?
Yes, we will come back to that if you don't mind. And that would be very interesting to come to India and see what India did, and why Gebser, if he would know about India and Vedic vision, he would really speak about it, I'm sure.
This came later.
Yes, it came later.
After this
book. Right. And he realized where the influence came
from. He wrote a book about India then.
The title, please, of the book, the title?
I don't remember exactly, but Discovery of the East.
Yeah, it is mentioned in the preface of the book.
And he's made trips, quite a few trips here.
So when we move to the mental structure, we have suddenly this directed dual opposition, the space, real body, objective, and me. Me and others, I, my consciousness, ego, forming thing. And the essence of it would be unification by synthesis and reconciliation. So I will have to reconcile. Now I will have to deal with that. I will have to plan how to do, how to survive, how to move. So I have a perspective. I can concentrate on one point. I can exclude others. This is the strength of consciousness. And finally it becomes spatial, abstractly temporal. So the time becomes an abstract property of space. Time disappears. We think about time only as a clock moves. It shows us what time is, otherwise we do not know. We refer to the clock This is the spatial reference. We see how the arrow moves and shows us where we are. We lost even temporicity of time. We do not know by sun and moon what time it is. We lost this capacity. We became spatial beings. We believe in outer objective world.
More worried also.
Yes.
More worried about dying.
About time.
Okay,
yes. We started to worry about dying. It's interesting because in the mythical structure it's not there. Dying and living was part of this process. It was all right. It was okay to die. There was nothing wrong about it. But now it becomes a very strange thing. You know, the space, where would you go in this dying? You know, which perspective you will take? Where is the path to go? It's tricky for our mind.
To anticipate a little bit also in deconstructionism and in the philosophy of, in critical philosophy and deconstruction, and especially in the work of Derrida, this concept emerges now, which is a sign of the emerging of the integral, where time begins to be seen as absence. Presence is what our consciousness depends upon. But it begins to realize that this temporal dimension is the absence of whatever is not in the perspective, but which is an integral part of the perspective. So the temporal dimension of things becomes unhidden in an integral thinking process. So then you do not see only what is present, but you see the totality of what is coming to be in the present also. So that I think is a return to that integral temporality, which is there somehow hidden.
This is a good preliminary remark to when we look into the integral and see what it does. It is presentiating. He coins his own terms. He doesn't want to speak about presentation, because presentation is a property of mental structure. We were joking about it in our Upanishadic class, that we are living by presentations, PowerPoint presentation. Without presentation, without presenting, we cannot really get it. It went so far that we have even professionals who make presentations for you in order to succeed to get your money. Nobody sees the real thing. It's only a presentation. It's constant, non-stop presentation. We don't live, he says. We present our life. And he speaks in a very interesting way about that to represent archaic structure, we cannot represent. We have to be. In magical structure, we have to live. In mythical structure, we have to experience. And in mental structure, we don't live, we don't experience, we are not, but we present and we conceptualize. That's what we do in the mental structure. And it's very important to see that all of them are present at the same time. That's what gives us an impression that our presentation is real, but it is not. The reality comes from the experience of the mythical structure, the life comes from our magic perception of oneness and one-pointedness, and our archaic origin gives us the sense of being. And that all fills in that our presentation, which is basically flat, which has no life, which is a separation of us from our nature, from time, freeing our soul from time, which is confusing.
What is absent is actually what is. What is present is something else.
In this presentation, yes. Agreed. So in the essence, integrality by integration and presentiation. Now, presentiation is a new term which he's coining, making actual. It's not presenting, it's presentiating, making actual, actualizing all the structures. And it makes quite a big difference. So it is aperspectival, it is transcending any perspective. You can take many perspectives together and hold them together in this aperspectival perception. It is space-free and time-free. Now, I will not go more into it for now, because this was an introduction and a first touch. It was already enough said. But I would welcome your remarks, your thoughts. And then we can go on, because we have to take more time with Dexter. There's much more, much more. And especially forms of realization and thought, articulation. There are beautiful things here to think of. How he treats religion, it's amazing, very beautiful. It explains everything, what is religion, religio, in the mythical structure. Religere, you can see here, observing, recollecting. It comes from recollection. We have to recollect about our origin. That's where we become religious. And religion as a believing system is part of the mental structure. Quite interesting. You will see new dimensions for your thought. So, that's enough said for today, I think, for the first introduction. So next time we continue our exploration, and we will have, let us do it like this, that we have first kind of presentation, 45 minutes altogether, of his content, and then we will have a discussion after break. Yes? Is it all right like that? Or you want to have no break? Break is good, right?
Yeah, lovely.
Okay, so we will have a 15 minutes break, and we will come back in, what is the time?
11:15.